Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, now writes his own blog. He, of course, writes our monthly newsletter, and, of course, one of the certainly most articulate spokesmen for the Americanist cause in our nation. William, it's so good to have you with us again tonight.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's always a privilege to be with you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So what are we going to address this evening?
On the theme, which we always touch on, of the need to abandon illusions, I think one of the most important illusions we need to dispel is that the FBI and federal law enforcement in general is in any sense involved in an effort to protect life, liberty, and property. These are all appendages of a government that is a wholly owned subsidiary of this transnational power elite or Brotherhood of Darkness, as you like to characterize them. Just in the last few days, we've seen the second instance this year in which the FBI, actually not the FBI in both instances, but in this instance, the FBI and the feds in general have rolled up two of their very prized assets who've been at the top of the most wanted list. The first, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who, contrary to deeply cultivated and erroneous impression, was not involved in the 9/11 attacks, according to the FBI, at least in terms of the evidence that was available. I find that disclosure to be really interesting, the fact that he was never on the most wanted list, identified as a suspect in that terrorist bombing. I think, once again, that's something we cannot overstate or italicize too frequently. But in any case, he started out as a bit player or a subsidiary of the CIA during the Afghan War, and there's reason to believe that that relationship continued well into the 90s or perhaps even into the early months of 2001. But he was rolled up, or at least supposedly, according to the reports we heard, he was rolled up just a few weeks ago. Just a couple of days ago, James Whitey Bulger, who is the former head of the Winter Hill Mob in Boston, or the so-called Irish Mafia, was finally reeled in. He had been living in Santa Monica in a quasi-private development where he and his 60-year-old girlfriend, Mr. Bulger, is in his 80s, had assumed the identity of a couple of retirees, paying cash for everything and making themselves largely inconspicuous. Mr. Bulger had been a federal asset since no later than the mid-50s. And during the 1970s, roughly 1974 until 1992 or 1993, he was a protected top echelon informant for the FBI. He was allowed to do pretty much anything he pleased to anybody he chose, as long as he provided actionable tips on his chief rival to power, which was the Boston branch of La Cosa Nostra, or the Italian mob. So he profited tremendously, and John Connolly, the FBI special agent who was his handler, profited as well from this relationship that ended up in being involved in the preventable murders of scores of people. And he was allowed to flee because Connolly tipped him off. He was rolled up a couple of days ago, and some disclosures about that relationship are probably in the offing.
Well, I think because Whitey Bulger tortured, he didn't just kill people.
Yes.
He tortured them to death. And if you've ever really studied this, it's one of the most horrible, discouraging stories to know the FBI was allowing this man to torture people to death and get away with it, as long as he was their informant. William, go right ahead.
John Connolly and Whitey Bulger both grew up in the Southie, which, of course, is a quasi-legendary section of Boston, which is inhabited primarily by working-class or upper-middle-class Irish. and they had known each other. They were childhood friends. Their relationship was somewhat fictionalized and romanticized for the Martin Scorsese movie The Departed, which came out a few years ago. Sometime in the early 1970s, when John Connolly was on the make as an FBI agent and Whitey Bulger was looking to establish himself as the chief crime lord of Boston, they struck up a relationship again. Bulger was somewhat older than Connolly. I believe he's maybe the better part of two decades older than Connolly. And so Connolly was somewhat in awe of Whitey Bulger. There had been a very carefully woven mythology in which Bulger swaddled himself to the effect that he was something of a Robin Hood type figure. Yes, he was running rackets, and he was running prostitution. He was involved in drug dealing and all kinds of untoward, unsavory activities. And occasionally, of course, he'd get his hands bloody. But the mythology held that he looked out for the little guy. He'd go after the people who were a little bit wealthier, a little bit more influential, but he had a heart for Southie, which, of course, was the most perfect nonsense. As you pointed out, Dr. Stan, here was somebody who had no compunctions about torturing people. According to a couple of his former associates, one of whom, Kevin Weeks, has written his own memoir. Kevin Weeks was one of his enforcers, a former amateur boxer. I believe he graduated from high school in 1974, who became a hitman and a muscle and gunman for Whitey Bulger. According to Kevin Weeks, Bulger and, I believe, Steve Flemmy, the so-called Rifleman Flemmy, who was one of his chief lieutenants, who was also a protected top echelon FBI informant, by the way, they both were voracious and unapologetic pederasts. And that's something that might have started way back in the 1950s in the case of James Bulger. He was called Whitey Bulger because he had platinum blonde hair. He's now bald, and what remains of his hair is outright white, you know, gray. He's a whore-headed guy in his ninth decade of life, but before he had this striking shock of platinum hair, hence the nickname Whitey. But way back in the 1950s, when he was put in federal prison as a result of a robbery conviction, an armed robbery conviction, I believe, he volunteered when he was in the penitentiary in Georgia for an experiment that was sponsored and funded by the CIA. So you're dealing here with another guy who was probably a CIA asset for as long as he's been a significant figure. Specifically, he was told that they were testing LSD as a potential cure for schizophrenia. So he was part of that whole Sidney Gottlieb-inspired mind control and psychoactive drug experiment that started way back in the 1950s when the CIA was basically the monopoly, had a monopoly on LSD.
Hold that thought, hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is going into the background of Whitey Bulger, and certainly Whitey Bulger had actually been arrested, put into prison, and he had volunteered for a CIA experiment, probably under Sidney Gottlieb, a CIA psychiatrist, and they were trying to find out how LSD worked, and they were using all these mind-control drugs. Anyone, what happened when they put Whitey Bulger into the CIA experiment?
It's not clear what happened in terms of changes to his personality. The hands-on administration of the drug was conducted by Dr. Jules Pfeiffer, who was working, if you follow the chain back, he was working under the notorious Dr. Gottlieb and that whole clique of people. But it was pretty clear that by the time he went to prison, he was, if not incorrigible, very difficult to consider redeemable, at least in terms of man's influence to rehabilitate himself. Of course, everybody is redeemable through God's grace. He's somebody who very aggressively shunned that blessing. But it's quite probable that owing to his exposure to LSD and the other aspects of this mind control experiment, that his innate corruptibility and his cultivated disregard for the rights of others became catalyzed and weaponized, if you will. So there's every reason to believe that this guy was not merely your common, ordinary ethnic gangster from the south side of Boston. He's somebody who had been refined into a very potent weapon of mayhem by the CIA. He went back to Southie in 1965 after getting time off from his sentence in exchange for being part of this experiment. And I think that the degeneracy that's been described by Kevin Weeks might have had something to do with Bulger's experience in prison. But he went back to Southie in 1965, and it was a very timely arrival for him because there were three critical developments that occurred. First of all, the FBI, under the direction of Robert Kennedy at the time, decided, after decades of insisting that the Italian mafia didn't exist. That's something that Hoover adamantly insisted until it became politically untenable to do so. They decided that they were going to go after La Cosa Nostra, or the mafia, as it's more commonly referred to.
I think it's vitally important, William, to mention the fact that J. Edgar Hoover, for many years, 20 years or more, covered for the Italian mafia, the Cosa Nostra. And the reason he did is because J. Edgar Hoover, paragon of virtue, was a homosexual. He was carrying on homosexual liaisons. And the Cosa Nostra had evidence of this. And we have books written by people in the FBI going into the background of the fact that all the agents knew that J. Edgar Hoover was a homosexual, although, of course, outwardly he supposedly hated homosexuals and that he would not allow a homosexual in the FBI, and yet he himself was a homosexual. He covered for the mafia because they had pictures of him in very compromised positions, and most of the agents knew this, and they simply kept quiet to keep their jobs. Have you heard those stories?
Oh, I've read enough on that subject that I'm convinced that you're summarizing accurately the reasons why Hoover was compromised. And, of course, this is ironic because Hoover was the keeper of the files. He's the person who inherited a lot of material from the original iteration of the FBI when it was just called the Bureau of Investigation. It's important to point out as well that the FBI, from its origins, has been, first of all, entirely unconstitutional, and secondly, a very dangerous prototype of a national political police agency, and third of all, it's been irredeemably corrupt from the beginning. That's not to say that everybody who's been employed by the FBI has been corrupt. I know many people within the FBI, some of them my age, some older, a few younger, who are public-spirited and patriotic people who are doing what they think is legitimate service to their country, and I suppose within the constrained circumstances they find themselves in, they're doing at least some objective good. But institutionally, from the very beginning, the FBI was an operation that was engaged in assembling what the Russians call kompromat, which is to say those notorious proverbial raw FBI files that are largely unfiltered gossip, but if you go and pan through them in the form of a miner panning for gold, you'll find the occasional valuable nugget of very compromising information. That's one of the reasons why Hoover was feared by everybody in the government, and so he ends up, of course, as Shakespeare would put it, being hoisted by his own petard when he was compromised himself. I mean, he was an extravagantly peculiar man by any definition, and he's somebody who had never been saddled with compunctions about using that kind of leverage against other people. And so, as you point out, Dr. Stan, for decades, owing to the fact that he was compromisable and compromised, the FBI was a silent partner with respect to the consolidation of power by many of these Italian crime syndicates. And when Robert Kennedy came to power as the Attorney General, of course, there is a real story as well. Robert Kennedy was the scion, as was JFK, of a family that had its roots in Prohibition-era bootlegging. And I need to window into another aspect of the story very quickly. Every time you have a prohibitionist policy that's enacted, the government is not trying to eradicate the vice, and it's not really trying to mitigate it, it's trying to monetize it. It's trying to create a profit center for the government by syndicating the distribution of vice, whether you're talking about drugs or prostitution or gambling. They simply want to find a way to interdict the funds and divert them into the most profitable avenues possible. And that means, of course, that they have to have a tacit symbiosis, a type of complicit or supportive relationship with an officially designated, although not publicly recognized, crime cartel. And that's where the Italian mob really found traction, was during Prohibition. And out of that era, of course, you have the Robert Kennedy, the Joseph Kennedy line, acquiring a fortune by being bootleggers at the time when we had this huge social experiment in alcohol prohibition, which did little more than cultivate violence and leave a lot of people blinded or killed from tainted alcohol, some of which was deliberately tainted by the federal government, and you have the consolidation and vertical integration of crime syndicates. By 1965, however, Robert Kennedy had said, we're going to go after La Cosa Nostra. We're going to go after them hammer and tongs. That's the first development that was to Whitey Bulger's benefit. The second was that just days before he went back to Southie, one of the informants for the FBI, a special agent by the name of Rico, who himself was known to prowl the flesh pots of the gay underworld there in Boston. That's where he met a lot of his informants. That's a really interesting dimension to the story as well. But this special agent Rico was running an informant named Jimmy the Bear Flemmy, who was, I believe, the father of Steve the Rifleman Flemmy, who became an intimate associate of Whitey Bulger. He murdered a thug by the name of Edward Deegan, and that, of course, was a complication, because if he's murdered somebody, the FBI is probably not going to be able to keep him on the payroll and use him as an informant and as an asset. And so in order to protect their informant, the Boston office of the FBI engaged in a brazen cover-up by finding four people who were admittedly not the most reputable sort of folks and framing them for the murder of Edward Deegan, which, of course, they didn't commit. So what they were doing after the fact, they were acting as accessories after the fact to a murder, and then they were guilty in framing four innocent men, innocent of this crime in any case, and sending them to prison. That's the second thing that happened that was to Whitey Bulger's advantage, because suddenly you've got the Boston FBI office in an outright bloody-handed collaborative relationship with the Winterhill Gang, the Irish Mafia. But the most important and propitious development for Whitey Bulger was the ascent of his brother, William, or Billy as he's referred to, in the state legislature. He eventually became the president of the Massachusetts Senate at the same time that John Bulger, Whitey, was the head of the Winterhill mob, and then Steve Connolly, the third leg of this tripod, was the head of the FBI office in Boston. So you had an iron triangle here that is the most remarkable construct, where you have the criminal underworld and the political overworld seamlessly integrated here to the mutual benefit of all three. And if you know anything about Boston political culture, the legislature there, as is the case in Chicago and of course, a number of other places in this country, but these two places in particular, like in Tammany Hall, the quasi-legendary pit of corruption in New York, you've got a situation where they are brazen and shameless in conferring largesse, basically by way of plunder, patronage, and bribery. And so you have really no moral distinction at all between the legislative branch of the government there and the activist branch of street-level crime syndicates. So you had the Bulger family create this dynasty that spanned the very narrow divide between the underworld and the criminal overworld. And so you had a situation where Billy Bulger was in a position that allowed him to dispense patronage and ladle out largesse as he saw fit. And so people like Paul Rico, this FBI agent who had been involved in the cover-up, the framing of these four men for the murder of Edward Deegan in order to protect the FBI informant, they were confronted with mandatory retirement at the age of 50. That's one of the things that J. Edgar Hoover wrote into the initial charter of the FBI. So they found themselves indecently eager to find favor with Billy Bulger, on the assumption, of course, that after they retired at 50, they could get some kind of a cushy sinecure in what is called a hack job. And hack jobs, of course, are a major industry for the political culture in Boston, just as they are in Chicago as well. And so they would be able to rack up arrests of Italian mobsters to earn promotions and pad their pensions, because if they ascended through the ranks, of course, they'd be able to expand the pensions that they could expect to receive at age 50. And at the same time, they had to take care of the Bulger family so that they would be able to double-dip by getting these perquisites and benisons from the state government. This became a self-perpetuating engine of corruption that ruined hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in Boston. And it was the FBI and the mob of the state government who were responsible for the carnage.
And, of course, we were all supporting the FBI in those years because,
yeah,
of course, it was anti-communist. And we know the communists are the big enemy and they're going to take over America, without realizing communism was being largely financed by our own government at every turn. The average individual to this day doesn't understand what Professor Sutton wrote about Wall Street and the rise of Bolshevism. And anti-communism was simply a cover to cover up the real criminals at the highest levels of government. William, go right ahead.
Of course, I agree entirely with Anthony Sutton's analysis of how the communist threat abroad, and I suppose the image of a communist threat here at home in terms of the peripheral and unsavory groups that cling to the leftward margin of politics has been inflated, exaggerated, overstated in terms of the existential menace it purportedly posed to us, while, of course, the government ruling us has enacted pretty much every plank of the Communist Manifesto. So they've been building communism here with non-communist hands, while invoking the menace of communism from without as a way of consolidating power and transfixing the minds of people who otherwise might look skeptically on what the government was doing here in the name of protecting us. I've mentioned before, and this once again is a bit of a digression, but I think it's relevant, how staggeringly bizarre it is that way back in 1952, the CIA agent who became the designated leader of American conservatism, William F. Buckley Jr., published an article in Commonweal magazine talking about the supposed need to employ and mobilize and conscript and regiment every aspect of American society in the Holy Crusade against foreign communism, even with an unsavory person like Harry S. Truman at the head of it all. The only way that we could confront communism abroad was by creating what he called, what Buckley called, the instrumentality of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. So his opening bid, this supposedly vigorous and impavid defender of freedom against communism, his opening bid was surrender. That is to say, you would start with totalitarianism as the default position in the battle against communism abroad.
But of course, what everybody's forgotten is William F. Buckley, skull and bones, just exactly like George Herbert Walker Bush and Sidney McGeorge Bundy and George W. Bush and Prescott Bush and John Kerry and Sidney, all these people. And of course, they're all in on this. It's a scam, but of course we can't let the American people know. Communism is terrible, communism is brutal, and communism has been financed since its origin from people right here in the United States. The ultimate goal of communism is the centralization of power with a ruling elite, and that's exactly what our invisible government, what our leaders here want. They want the same things. They work together, they work in concert. They worked in concert starting in 1918. They're working very closely with the communists in both Russia and China today. And the average American has no grasp of what's going on. Go right ahead with him.
You talk about Skull and Bones, which is, of course, this esoteric German-founded secret society at Yale. And it's described in some circles as a fraternity. It's substantially more than a fraternity. You should point out, it's a way of pooling the most promising of the elite for the purpose of recruiting them into positions of influence. The CIA basically coalesced out of Skull and Bones. There's no other way to describe that relationship. Once again, our debt of gratitude is to Professor Sutton for doing the spade work in the definitive expose, the initial revelatory expose on the order of Skull and Bones. But there's an interesting parallel here to the Mafia. And, of course, I'm referring now to La Cosa Nostra, the Italian Mafia, which is the one with which most people are familiar. The Italian Mafia, this thing of ours, which is what La Cosa Nostra means, is an oath-bound criminal fraternity where people...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is simply pointing out that Cosa Nostra is a secret society where you have secret oaths and secret... It's all basically a secret society. Very similar to Skull and Bones. Very, very similar, of course, to the original Masons. In fact, the original Mafia, Sicilian Mafia, was an outgrowth of Masonry. Oh, my goodness, most people don't see how it all fits together. But all of these things interlock, because, of course, they all have strong spiritual forces behind them. Pick up the story there, William.
And even if you don't subscribe to the idea that spiritual forces are relevant in terms of how they play out in the world as we perceive it and tangibly experience it, the point is that these people are seriously committed to these principles, and they believe in the spiritual force that is generated through certain types of ritual and certain covenants that they enter into. They believe it, and they're willing to act on their ideals, perverted, torqued, and depraved as they are. And the point is that even if you believe that this is the most perfect nonsense, that it's all adolescent mummery of the sort that little kids engage in when they have a club in their treehouse complete with funny hats and secret handshakes and passwords, even if you believe that it's nothing more than that in terms of the tangible impact of what they do, the gestures, the rituals, and so forth, they take this stuff seriously. And these are people in a position where they can make it a matter of great importance to us because they understand the need to be faithful to what they have sworn to do, to be supportive to their brothers in these oath-bound fidelities and fraternities at the expense of the rest of us. And that's how the world really operates at a level below the headlines and below the scrutiny of people with graduate degrees in political science. The fact is that this matters. This matters a great deal, whether you're talking about the type of people who make their bones and then become made men in mafia initiation rituals involving the symbolic burning of a saint and swearing on various things that are regarded as holy to them that they will be faithful to this oath-bound criminal fraternity, or are you talking about the types of things that people who enlist in Skull and Bones undergo that involve, among other things, this is once again a way of underscoring the importance of blackmail leverage in the workings of the power elite, that is a condition of enlisting in the Skull and Bones fraternity and having access to all of the rewards and career security that this entails. They have to compromise themselves. They have to disgorge all the intimate and potentially seamy and sordid and embarrassing details of their past, their inclinations, their appetites. This is the sort of thing where they strip themselves bare so as to make themselves vulnerable. And in their vulnerability, of course, they find themselves wedded to this order and to its objectives. And this helps explain why somebody who's as nondescript and undistinguished and eminently mediocre as a George W. Bush can end up being propelled into the White House. Here's somebody who spent most of his adult life in a self-induced haze owing to chemical abuse of various kinds. He had no aptitude for business. He had no discipline. He had no direction. He was cruising on the basis of his father's achievements. Of course, he was a multi-generational member of the Skull and Bones fraternity. His grandfather had been a Skull and Bones man. His dad, of course, George Bush the Elder, had been a very famous bonesman. George Bush, when he was initiated into the fraternity, didn't even bother to reset the default name he was given. His secret Skull and Bones name, of course, he's not going to admit it. He was asked about it on television. He said, "I can't talk about that," just as John Kerry said the same thing when he had two bonesmen running for the presidency in 2004. But according to exposés that have been written, his name is still temporary within the facility. Within the fraternity, he's still known as temporary, which, of course, is a placeholder until he can think something up. But you take a look at how his career was aided at every significant juncture when he had basically buried himself in a pit of his own failure. He was bailed out on at least three separate occasions by people who were bonesmen buddies of his dad. You take a look at the purchase of the Texas Rangers baseball team, which is probably the only thing for which he had even minimal competence because he was interested in baseball. All the investors, the co-investors who helped him buy the Texas Rangers team, were bonesmen. These people basically pulled out their checkbooks when they were contacted by George Bush's bonesman dad, and they were willing to write checks in order to help him buy his own baseball team, to give him some kind of a platform he could stand on while bonesmen behind the scenes, beginning with his dad, put together a political career that put him on a track to the White House. So once again, there are deep and intimate and specific parallels between the oath-bound criminal underworld and the oath-bound political overworld. And this story of James Whitey Bulger is just one peek into how this operates, and it's a thoroughly disgusting sight.
And, of course, it was the FBI agent who was his Whitey Bulger's contact who actually told Bulger the police were coming.
Yes.
He better get out of town. And, well, he got out of town for 16 years he's been hiding. And we'll be back in just a moment here with William Greig right here at Radio Liberty.
Grateful for a land so fair.
Well, William, you go right ahead.
James Whitey Bulger was recruited as a top echelon informant in 1975, and as you point out, Dr. Stan, it was his handler, John Connolly, who 20 years later, almost exactly 20 years later, gave Whitey Bulger the news that the feds were preparing to indict him on about a score of murder charges. So Bulger had about a 20-year career here as a protected asset of the FBI. By this time, John Connolly had retired, and he was luxuriating in the corrupt proceeds of his thoroughly disreputable career. During that 20-year period, according to Bulger and Fleming, Steve the Rifleman Fleming, I love these nicknames, who was recruited in 1970 as an FBI informant, they would scrape up what meager intelligence they could find on the Italian mob and pass it along to the FBI, and the FBI went out and eliminated the only competition that the Winter Hill Gang had to control over the rackets and the other underworld operations in Boston. And this relationship really took the form of almost a kind of alchemy. As Fleming said, me and Whitey gave the feds, and I won't use the word he used, but it refers to digestive residue. We would give them garbage, and they gave us gold. But this was a 20-year period where the Winter Hill Gang consolidated power because the FBI was taking out their competition. And at the same time, the FBI assets working hand in glove with the Winter Hill Gang were consolidating power as well. They had parallel careers, and they rose to the top. And at the time, of course, William Bulger, John's brother, was atop the throne of the Senate in Boston as well. And it's important to recognize that this isn't something that is completely innocuous or utterly insulated from the experience of people in Boston and in Miami and elsewhere in the country. There were people who were murdered, scores of people who were murdered, who had done nothing but simply get in the way of some corrupt appetite that Bulger and Fleming and their associates wanted to indulge, and the FBI was willing to let them indulge it, just as they were willing to frame four people for a murder that they didn't commit in order to protect an informant in 1965. And one of the things that I talk about, and I've written about this, as a matter of fact, if you go to the American...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan in Cursive. What is so incredible is that the FBI, to cover for this murderer, Whitey Bulger, framed four innocent men. They knew they were innocent and put them in prison for murder. And so these were men who did not commit this murder. Whatever they had done, it was a phony conviction. Everybody knew it was a phony conviction, and they sent innocent men to prison to cover for their informant, who is actually Whitey Bulger, who tortured at least 19 people to death, or tortured many of them to death. Horrible, horrible, horrible stories. And the FBI knew this, and they allowed it to go in, because they wanted, of course, to get the Italian mafia and allow the Irish mafia to operate. But it made the FBI look good. And, of course, they didn't care how many lives were lost. And they didn't care about sending innocent men to prison. That's why you can, unfortunately, not trust the FBI. Because nobody was anybody ever... I know this one FBI agent went to prison over that. Did he ever get out of prison?
I think he's still in prison. He was up for parole last year. And last I heard, he's still behind bars. What's really interesting is that the FBI employees union intervened on his behalf, trying to get John Connolly out of prison at the earliest parole date. John Connolly, and I've been referring mistakenly to Whitey Bulger as John. His name is actually James. It's James Bulger and John Connolly, and for some reason I've been transposing those names. James Whitey Bulger was the mobster, and John Connolly was his FBI handler. But John Connolly, in the late 1990s, before he was put on trial for racketeering and eventually convicted, John Connolly was actually shopping a screenplay about himself, trying to create an image of himself as the man who took down the mob in Boston, when, of course, he's the guy who consolidated the real mob in Boston, the Winter Hill Gang. But one of the things about that relationship, and I want to point out that this is, I'm convinced, not at all an anomaly. I am convinced that this is the sort of thing that the feds, the FBI in particular, have been engaged in everywhere in the country where their interests have dictated it, is that Mr. Connolly, James or John Connolly, was not merely a passive accomplice. He's not something who was merely an accessory after the fact when these murders were carried out. There was one incident, according to Kevin Weeks, and Kevin Weeks testified against Connolly in 2002 in the racketeering trial. There was at least one instance in which Connolly actually rode along and took part in a mob hit. And Weeks also said that there were at least a half a dozen FBI agents. This is the part of the story, Dr. Stamp, that really needs to be followed up on. And this is what I'm waiting for now that they have Bulger in custody. Of course, he's at an age now where they could dispose of him and it would look like natural causes. So I'm suspecting that he's not long for this plane of existence. And what comes afterwards, in his case, is probably not going to be terribly pleasant. But if he's allowed to speak, we might find out a little bit more about one particular accusation leveled by Kevin Weeks, who'd been his lieutenant, muscle and gun guy once again, that there were at least a half a dozen FBI agents who would be at the beck and call of Connolly, which is to say at the beck and call of James Bulger, and he could call them any time, and they would willingly hop in the car with him and a machine gun. So they were actually, in a literal sense, in terms of the actual rubber hits the road or the bullet hits the bone role, partners, full partners in promoting and protecting the Winter Hill Gang. And the other thing that I think is really important to recognize here, and this has to do once again with the degenerate political culture in Boston, which is just an exaggerated or an amplified version of the quotidian corruption that characterizes American politics, is that there were many instances where the little guy, the proverbial unconnected little guy, found himself steamrollered by the Winter Hill Gang with the FBI's outright connivance. I mentioned just before the break that I had published a story about this 5 years ago in the American Conservative. There was a book review I wrote of Howie Carr's book, The Brothers Bulger, How They Terrorized and Corrupted Boston for a Quarter Century. Howie Carr is a writer for the Boston Herald, and he's also a local talk show host. I believe he still has a radio program. He made himself more or less the go-to guy in the Boston media in exposing what Bulger was up to. And at one point, he actually was the subject of a contract that had been put out by Bulger. And if he had been killed, I don't think that there would have been serious repercussions, because this is taking place at a time when Bulger was still protected by the FBI. And he assigned Kevin Weeks, his henchman, to go out and put a bullet in the head of Howie Carr, because Howie Carr had been pestering him and insulting him, and Bulger, of course, had a notoriously short temper when he was dealing with people who made him look bad. And Kevin Weeks was sent out to pick off Howie Carr as he picked up his daughter from school, and so Weeks had found a sniper nest, and he was just waiting to do this. And he fixed sights on Howie Carr, but he couldn't pull the trigger, because he just couldn't countenance the possibility that a ricochet might end up killing Howie Carr's daughter or injuring another school child. And then he thought, I just can't sit here and gun down this guy in front of his grade school age daughter. Now, I think it's an interesting thing to contrast that with what Lon Horiucci did at Ruby Ridge. Lon Horiucci knew that he had Vicki Weaver in his gun sights. When he was asked under oath what he saw when he looked through the targeting scope of his sniper rifle, he drew a picture of Vicki Weaver's head. She was cradling a newborn suckling infant, and yet he found it within himself to pull the trigger.
Now, this is a FBI sniper who actually killed
him. FBI sniper, yes.
Right. So the FBI sniper didn't think he had no compulsions about killing this woman holding an infant in her arms, as in the wife of the gentleman there.
Randy
Weaver, but of course the mafia sniper did have compunctions about it. The difference between the FBI and the mafia, at least there's a sense of honor in the mafia.
Yeah, some residual embattled and all but destroyed sense of honor, but there's a residue of it nonetheless. So I've said on a couple of occasions that in the distinction between Kevin Weeks's decent self-restraint in not taking the shot and Lon Horiucci's willingness to take that shot, in that difference we find the precise meaning of the phrase good enough for government work. And the point is that the FBI hired, trained, deployed Lon Horiucci, protected him. He's in the witness protection program now. because he's somebody who is quite understandably the focus of a great deal of lasting public anger because he just committed brazenly an act of criminal homicide as part of this horrible siege of the Randy Weaver home in 1992. But beyond that, he's somebody who for at least a couple of years was actually the subject of a criminal homicide warrant here in the state of Idaho. And it was scotched not by the Boundary County, I believe it was Boundary County prosecutor. This is something that was put aside by the state attorney general under pressure from Washington. And I think it's sort of ironic there because I believe the county prosecutor's name was Woodbury. The county prosecutor at the time was a female, and she proved herself to be more of a man than the pseudo-male, the nominal man, who was the attorney general at the time, who yielded to federal pressure. There was actually going to be a criminal homicide trial for Lon Horiuchi. So he's a protected gangster as well. And, of course, he's not spent time living at public expense and looking at striped sunlight, but he really should, in as much as what he did was an objective crime. And the same sort of thing that Kevin Weeks was tasked to do by this FBI-protected asset, Whitey Bulger. But the other case that I find so striking here, by way of illustrating how this works in terms of this relationship between the underworld and the overworld, is the story of a man by the name of Steve Rakes, who's sometimes known as Steve Stippo Rakes. Once again, these nicknames are colorful and somewhat diverting. In 1983, he and his wife, they were married at the time. They subsequently divorced for reasons that I'll probably hint at here in just a second. They had been working odd jobs and saving money. They finally put together enough money to buy a liquor license at an auction. They auction liquor licenses in Boston. That's just one element, once again, of how this political culture works. They were able to buy a small piece of commercial property on Old Colony Avenue. It was the only one that had convenient parking. And so they bought this property. They got the liquor license. They spent over $100,000. Once again, this is $1983 dollars we're talking about. And this is a young couple of modest means and relatively small ambitions. They were able to put out $100,000 to buy the property, get the license, and renovate it, and open it during the Christmas season, just in time for New Year's in 1984. Well, just after they opened it, they got a visit from a couple of people they didn't know. One of them was Whitey Bulger, one of them was Kevin Weeks, and a third one was Steve Fleming. And they showed up and said, basically, we want to take this property off your hands, and we'll give you $67,000 for it. And $67,000, of course, didn't cover what they had laid out. And they said that there was a problem in as much as some of the other liquor store owners in the area wanted to kill them, because they didn't like the competition. They were, of course, the only store that had a convenient parking space here on this very busy avenue. What had happened is that Whitey Bulger had become aware of this facility, and he wanted to find a way of creating a hideout, a headquarters, like the Ravenite Club that was used by the Dapper Don, John Gotti, in New York. He wanted to have a place that would be a legitimate business that he could use for laundering money from his illicit proceeds. He also wanted to have a secure base of operations that wouldn't be penetrable by anybody he didn't control. And by this time, he controlled pretty much everybody in local and federal law enforcement, much of the highway patrol there as well. And so he decided that he was going to chase these people off. Well, what this was, essentially, was an act of eminent domain. He decided that the fair market value of that property was $67,000, which was appreciably less than these people had paid. They weren't interested in the deal, and so Whitey Bulger threatened to bomb them out and then to kill them, and at one point he visited them at their home, and one of his henchmen took out a gun and actually put it into the mouth of their infant daughter, not infant, two-year-old toddler daughter, and said something to the effect of, it would just be a terrible thing for her to grow up without you, you know, looking at Steve Rakes as he said this. Well, eventually they terrorized these people into signing over the property, and they ended up with $67,000 and a huge debt that they couldn't pay off. And poor Steve Rakes and his wife eventually divorced 7 or 8 years later in 1991. And by that time, news was starting to come out about the relationship between Bulger and the FBI. But at this time, the Stippo liquor store was taken over and renamed the South Boston Liquor Mart. And at John Connolly's retirement party in 1990. That's the year before Steve and his wife divorced. They had the whole Boston FBI office present, and they were. It was held there at the South Boston Liquor Mart that had belonged to Steve Rakes. So he was eventually summoned to testify before two grand juries, and he refused to talk. This was in the later mid-1990s, because he had a wife and two daughters, an ex-wife by this time, and two daughters. He wasn't willing to testify because it had been made clear to him what would happen to him if he spoke out. During the time that Whitey Bulger was blackmailing him and trying to get him to turn over the property, Steve and his wife approached a friend of theirs who worked for the Boston... Actually, no, he worked, I believe, for the Highway Patrol, the Massachusetts Highway Patrol, and described what had happened. And their friend, who was in law enforcement, said, well, what you need to do is you need to talk with the Organized Crime Division of the FBI. And so he went right to guess who? He went right to John Connolly and told him what was going on. And it was because Rakes had talked to his friend in the police department and thereby turning the information over to the FBI that he ended up having his life threatened and ended up being browbeaten into turning over the ownership of the property that he had bought on the basis of his own sweat and credit. And so he'd learned the hard way that it just wouldn't work to trust in any law enforcement agency in the area to protect him. So he wasn't going to cooperate with the grand jury. He was eventually indicted and convicted of perjury. He wasn't sent to prison, but he was convicted of perjury, and that made him almost unemployable because he's now a federal felon on probation. And so he faced an eviction, an outright destitution, by the early years of the 21st century, late 1990s, early 2000s. And so he plaintively approached the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority to see if he could find some kind of a make-work hack job. And he was told that he could have a job in exchange for a $3,000 bribe. Now, he and his ex-wife have sued Connolly and a number of other people who are responsible for what happened to them. They brought suit in 2001. It was heard by a U.S. District Court in 2004, and then it was thrown out in 2006. The reason was that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, the statute of limitations supposedly was exhausted by the time they were fully aware of what had happened. So the federal government, which only allows itself to be sued when it waives what's called sovereign immunity, which, by the way, is a horrible, horrible principle that is completely incompatible with small-r republican institutions, they had set this narrow window of opportunity for people who were affected by this FBI mob alliance to file some kind of a tort claim. And then they very carefully kept from public disclosure anything that would be compromisable until the statute of limitations had run out. Now that Bulger is in custody, Mr. Rakes and a number of other people, including the family of a businessman from Oklahoma who was murdered in Miami as part of an FBI-condoned hit. He was murdered in Oklahoma in order to seize control of a business in Miami, if I remember correctly. They're filing suit again, and they're going to try to see if it would be possible at long last to receive some kind of compensation, some kind of remuneration for the injustices they have suffered. But again, you're taking a look at a case here, a story that offers this core sample of this multi-layered and mutually reinforcing official corruption that starts at the top and runs all the way down into the murky and miasmic depths of the criminal underworld. And it's all a question of who happens to be in power and how best to serve their interests at the expense of everybody else. People on both sides of this very narrow divide, this gap separating the underworld from the overworld, have no compunctions, no scruples, no conscience. They have no public-spiritedness. They don't see us as people with rights that they are required to protect. Those who are in the political realm supposedly swear an oath to protect the Constitution, to protect their rights. They're at best indifferent to that, if not outright hostile. And people on the other side of the proposition don't make any pretense of having an interest in their rights. But you know what? Ironically enough, the private element of this public-private partnership, the mob rather than the government, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, that is still hampered with some residual sense of honor and decency. On the other side, on the federal side, they have no such impediments.
What a sad, sad commentary. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in a fallen world. And if you don't believe God is going to bring his judgment on this world, I think that you are going to be very, very surprised. I think we're moving very, very rapidly. The signs are all there. Get the scriptures out, read them, and then think about what William has been talking about tonight. You think that this is simply going to pass without without retribution? Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap the program up.
Dr. Stan, as always, it's been a pleasure and a privilege to be with you. And I want to emphasize that even when we find ourselves immersed in stories of this sort, we cannot give up. I have a motto that I use at the end of every blog post and at the end of every one of my radio programs, Dum Spiro Pugno, while I breathe, I fight. We are required to fight, and quite frankly, if we're not willing to fight, we're not really living. And how we fight, of course, is dictated by our circumstances and by the allotment of talents that God has given us. But we really have no excuse not to be doing something, if only actively exposing, complaining, and agitating against and condemning the evil that we see, naming it for what it is, and trying to mobilize people to oppose it. One of the things I do at my blog, Pro Libertates, at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, is I try to inform people and enrage them about what's going on. Now, to penetrate this induced fog of torpor and lethargy, and that's one of the reasons why I do what I do, and I do it as emphatically as I can. I know you've been doing the same thing now for decades, Dr. Stan, and there are people who have finally been roused from their stupor and are doing something about it. That's a very hopeful sign. Things are going to grow immensely ugly. They're going to grow geometrically uglier very quickly. And we're going to have to be willing to fight. We're going to have to find the steel within our spines. And in order to do that, of course, in order to find the steel in our spines, we have to bend our knees every once in a while. So that's a very productive activity, and that should be very much a part of the fight that we undertake, knowing that, you know, one man with God, quite frankly, is an invincible majority. Whatever happens in this realm of existence, we know that there is a reward for those who are willing to do what is right because it is right.
Amen to that. I'm often reminded of those words, Winston Churchill, still, if you'll not fight for the right, you can easily win without bloodshed. If you'll not fight for your victory, it will be sure and not too costly. You may come to the moment when you'll have to fight with all odds against you and only a perilous chance of survival. Or there may be even a worse case. You may come to the moment when you'll have to fight when there is no hope for victory, for it would be better to perish than to live as slaves. And even though I think that sometimes Winston Churchill, well, there's a great deal to be said about him and his background and his Druid foundation, he still was a great orator. And that is one of the most profound statements. It's one that has inspired me through the years. Disillusioned, perhaps, by Winston Churchill, but not by his words, which, of course, have that eternal truth, the ring of eternal truth. Hang on, William, because I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your ministry, and I want to bring them all back now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Before we let William go, William, I want to tell our listeners how they can get out to your blog, how they can get to your radio program, how they can get to your PayPal button.
Dr. Stan, I appreciate that. Once again, my blog, Pro Libertate, Libertate, is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate Radio. It's at the Liberty News Radio Network from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. every Sunday afternoon. It's 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock Central Time every Sunday afternoon. LibertyNewsRadio.com has all the information with respect to broadcast times and also the archives of my radio program. You mentioned, Dr. Stan, that at the end of every essay on my blog, there is a PayPal button that people can use to donate, and many generous people have done so, and I am immensely grateful to them and eternally grateful to you, Dr. Stan, for everything you've done on behalf of me and my family and my efforts to keep going in terms of this information warfare we're involved in. With respect to the story of James Bulger, American Conservative Magazine, theamericanconservative.com, has republished my article from 5 years ago about the origins of this alliance between the Winterhill Mob and the FBI and James Whitey Bulger and John Connolly. I believe it's still up at the website there. It's how the Bulgers bought Boston, I believe is the title of the article. How Whitey Bulger bought Boston. And it's at amconmag.com. Once again, amconmag.com. The current issue of American Conservative Online. It's on the front page of the website, the second article down right now. And so if people are interested in learning more about this horrible story, that's the place they can go.
God bless. We'll talk to you later. Thanks very much.
God bless you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Chris William Craig. I always look forward to his being with us on Friday evening. Certainly one of the most articulate people we have in the movement today. And so if you'd be interested in helping us as we, get William to write our monthly newsletter, does a magnificent job. And if you'd be interested in supporting Radio Liberty, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. You want to understand how it fits together? My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my talks on the secret, the forbidden secret, the dark secret, the syllabuses that go together with that. If you'd like to know about the supernatural, we have a 4-tape set on the supernatural, Satanic Crimes. We have a 4-tape set and a book by that title. If you'd like to know about the Return of the Giants, we have a great 4-CD set. That's Conversations with Barry Shamish, who investigated the supernatural phenomenon in Israel between 1988 and 1999 and talked to the people who saw the giants. We have, of course, two great 4-CD sets, each one on the Illuminati, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, part one, part two, quite unforgettable. We recommend this to you. That's Dr. Dennis Cuddy on the Illuminati. And then, of course, you need to understand it's not imaginary. It's very real. You can even get the document that Dr. Cuddy and I liberated from the Library of Congress over tremendous opposition on the Clintonian Illuminati in New England, and it was written in 1804, and it's available to Radio Liberty. We do hope, of course, that many of you out there will want to certainly go to our website, radioliberty.com, and certainly you can listen to our radio programs there for nothing. You can read our newsletters there for nothing. You can actually listen to our radio programs there on a regular basis, and we hope that you go there, access the information, tell others, because that's how we're getting the information out. And then we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision, and for our protection. And so until next week, at the same time, we'll be back once again. Dr. Stan Kenighton, may the Lord be with you.